Absolutely fantastic. And what a contrast in the two sounds. And I would like to actually, I hope Paul is on the line now. Hello, Paul. How are you?
Hi, Athena. Keeping well here.
Very good. In Hollywood.
In Hollywood is correct.
In Hollywood. Just to go straight in, Paul, into your craft, really, I suppose. I just played two tracks there from your YouTube channel of two different instruments that you made. And just to tell us a little bit, I suppose, about your craft. You're 26 years a violin maker at this stage, graduating in London, or in the UK, I know, in 1997. And, you know, I suppose a lot of people would wonder, like, what's the difference between instruments and what's involved in the craft itself?
Yeah, well, I suppose most of the instruments that we know are either copies or based upon a Stradivari model or a Guarneri model. These are the two the most famous makers of all time. But even if you look at any single one of those makers, there were developments in their craft where they, you know, made different models, different shapes and forms of fiddles.
Yeah.
It's hard to say, you know, in a succinct one-liner, you know, what the difference is. But basically, you know, the elements that we're dealing with when we're making violins or fiddles are the materials that we're using, the quality and the nature of the material, and also the shaping of the arching of the front and the back, and the stiffness of the wood that we're using. And the thicknessing then of the fronts and backs. These are the main dynamics that we're dealing with when we're making a fiddle. And the outcome is an overall summary of, by the maker, you know, of how all these things will work together in a given instrument.
And Paul would say, like, the music itself or the different styles of music, was there a particular association with each violin maker of that is kind of a signature style of their own?
Well, I suppose if you were to look simply at Guarneri and Stradivari, Stradivari came from the Amati tradition of making. There were three generations of master violin makers in the Amati family before Stradivari learned from Niccolò Amati, who was the last generation of the Amati family. So he would have inherited that tradition of making, which was Cremonese from in the city of Cremona. And then, of course, the Amati family were not the only family. Stradivari continued that tradition, but he developed it into something more robust. And he actually drew from other sources in Brescia, for example, developing wider instruments and flatter arched instruments in his later period than you would find in Amati tradition of making.
And would that be, a format that you would follow yourself as a violin maker, or would you draw on a number of different influences, or just your evolving experience yourself?
It's a bit of both.
Yeah.
In the world of violin making today, of course there is a sort of people who dominate the taste or the trends, and these are dealers and collectors and banks and people who buy these top class instruments. You know, so there's a lot of emphasis on copying exactly the originals. But there are also people who are more free spirited than that and do their own thing within more or less within the parameters, using the dynamics of the original instruments. You know, I tend to do both. You know, and within that, it's a bit like traditional music. You know, if you're playing something in the traditional idiom, you can do what you want as long as you don't really create something that is, not within the taste or the idiom. So that's the same with violin making, exactly the same.
Yeah. And would you find there is a big difference between the demand for the violins between the genres of music, or is it balanced between, we'll say, classical players versus traditional players, or?
I wouldn't see any clear correlation between those. But what you do see is there's an increase in awareness among traditional players, I mean, of the quality of instruments that are available to them, and you know, how much more that can increase their scope for playing. So you do get traditional players buying what we would have one time called violins rather than fiddles, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, so this seems to be part of the modern trend. I suppose if people are in general a bit wealthier, you know, and more educated, and of course there are more instrument makers around than there used to be. I mean, in Ireland when I was growing up, there were only a handful of fiddle makers. There probably still aren't that many, but I suppose like you're looking back to Perry as being one of the, you know, one of the early makers in Ireland.
And do you find then that clients that would be looking for a violin or a fiddle either from you would have, we'll say, set out particular parameters about the type of tone that they're looking for and the action and, the, you know, the difference between the sound from the G string to the E string and the balance in that? And, you know, do they have particular requirements or is it based on sampling your fiddles?
It is. Some people, I mean, I have sold quite a few fiddles on commission where people, you know, have heard what my instruments sound like online.
Yeah.
I've just bought, you know, ordered one, say, yeah, I'll have one of those, you know. So that happens. And then you have people who, you know, they, you know, by and large, violin makers don't have a lot of instruments sitting around, you know, they make to commission. But, there are people who wouldn't buy an instrument that way because they like to have it in their hand and play it before they get it, and that's understandable as well. So I coach if someone gives me a commission, of course I'd make them the fiddle. But if someone's interested in what they've already heard of one of my instruments and they want to try one, I'll do my best to have one that they can try or maybe more than one, you know, maybe whatever I have around the time, you know.
And I suppose that brings me that question. I suppose I was asking that from the point of view of it's not as easy to access and try out an instrument at the moment. And I suppose that's why I was wondering, are people, you know, purchasing through commissions? And I know that, you know, lockdown in the last 12 months, you've been making a lot more instruments, but how have you been able to navigate, I suppose, the your merchandise in the last 10, 11 months?
What I've been doing is, for example, you know, I also sell other instruments that I haven't made myself. Oh. So, for example, I posted a 3/4 size fiddle out to someone to try last week, and I'm posting a full size fiddle out to someone this week to try. Now, if it wasn't a lockdown situation, I wouldn't do that because you don't obviously know what state you're going to get them back in. But by and large, you know, people are very respectful, and the postal service, I have no complaints with it. I have a postal Bowery here, what would you say, service.
Business, yeah.
And I've never lost a bow or had a bow damaged in the post, and they've never arrived late or anything either.
That's brilliant. So people, if you need your bow rehaired, you can just send it off and you can send it back, and it's a very safe method of doing that.
Yeah, what people do is they put the bow inside a waven tube, just a piece of down tube that you would get by for the sink, as long as it's wide enough, and the packet both ends of it with a newspaper or rags, and then they just tape over the ends and they post it to me. So it's a pretty secure way of doing it,
and effective of course, means of continuing and still working in the meantime.
That's it, yeah.
It's really, really interesting, and I suppose the whole thing about violin making is just such a large topic. You could talk about it for endlessly, really, you know. And I suppose it just as well as the violins, they're just talking about your own music, Paul. You know, and your own influences. Like I know you were hugely influenced by Tommy Peoples, I suppose, as a young lad of about 13 or 14 years of age, and and I suppose your own style is a very powerful style, and you've I suppose expressed in been influenced a lot by his double stops and crans and his infamous, I suppose, treble bowing as well, as a young lad, and you've kind of I suppose moulded them into your own style over the years.
That would be true. I think the first time I was just so taken by Tommy's playing. I had been listening to lots of players at the time, you know, all the players that were available on the usual outlet, record outlets. But Tommy's playing just had something. It had so many different emotions contained within it that it was just so appealing. But when I started to learn from Tommy's playing, I suppose I was always, even at a very early age, aware that I never really wanted to copy anybody. I just wanted to learn something from them. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that means copying them for some period, you know, until you get your feet as a player, you know. Mm-hmm. So there were a number of great players that I listened a lot to, like Tommy Potts and Paddy Clacken and Kevin Burke and Sean Keane and lots of these were the players, the contemporary players who were on record at the time. And then, of course, players like John Doherty and Michael Coleman. And there was a very wide palette of, you know, music available on disc to me, you know. Yeah. Plus then, I suppose, when I first started getting out of the house, going to sessions in Belfast, there were lots of great players there to learn from, players like Brian Sutherland, Brian Montague, Andy Dixon, and Ben Gunn. There was like a lot of the fiddle was the main instrument in the counties of Ulster. You know, yeah. There really wasn't any other instrument, to be quite frank. You know, yeah. There was a little bit of flute playing here and there, like, but it was largely a fiddle tradition.
And of course, you had family members. I mean, you're the youngest of 12 from your own family in Armagh. And of course, you know, a couple of fluent Irish speakers in their music household. You're a bit of a poet yourself, I believe. And your mom was very much a poet. And all of that, as the youngest of 12 siblings, obviously had a huge influence as well, Paul, had it?
Yeah, well, I suppose, like, as they say, I was the scrapings of the barrel, the last one to arrive, you know, and it was just like a whole load of people, you know. Maybe Lawrence would have been playing a bit of the banjo, and Joe had an accordion, Pat had an accordion, Dominic played the fiddle, and Joe was at the fiddle as well. Bernie was a singer, and Geraldine was a singer and played the guitar. So everybody was doing a bit, you know, and it was largely, you know, not really expected of us, or was there very little encouragement really parentally. It was just in us to do it. And my brother used to joke, you know, that while some parents were trying to beat the music into their children, my parents were trying to beat it out of us.
Absolutely. And I suppose, as you say, that it wasn't drilled into you by your parents, but that, as you said, you were saturated community wise with being surrounded with all the great fiddle players around you.
Well, there were fiddle players. I'm from a little mill village, which was like sort of it was like a little snippet of a city in the countryside. It was an industrial village.
Yeah.
So there were fragments of, you know, there was, for example, a native Irish speaker and a melodeon player who lived in one of the little streets, mill cottages, like, or were not cottages, they were like industrial houses. Mm. And his son was a fiddle player, Oney O'Neill, he was called. And then there were other fiddle players around the area. But most of those fiddle players of the real old tradition of, I suppose you'd call real old style Ulster playing, were you know, around before my time, there were the my older brothers now, who are a lot older than me, would have known them to some extent. But then there was another wave of music that came after that, with the likes of Josephine Keegan and Sean Maguire, and you know, the Morphy brothers from Cross MacLean, and they were at the Keeley Band era. And it was a new music. It wasn't like, there was an older rural music that was before the Keeley Bands, which I didn't directly experience, you know. It was more this other type of music I was hearing, I suppose.
Yes, I know what you mean. I just have, before, staying on the topic, I suppose, of violin making, just to, you know, your interest in it. How did it evolve from being a fiddle player into violin making? I know at some point you were interested in pipe and reed making.
That's right. My first desire actually probably was to play the flute, maybe, because I had a flute, and my brother was my brother's flute, and I think eventually he sold it off and I was bereft of the flute. But then my interest shifted to the pipes, and so I loved listening to piping, and I didn't get a set of pipes. It was actually the fiddle came from my brother. He brought the fiddle into the house for me, you know, and so then piping became part of my fiddle playing, in the sense that I was listening to piping a lot. And then my ambition then at the age 14 was to make a set of pipes, and I was in Milltown Malby when I was 14, and I bought Wilbert Garvin's book on pipe making, and the same year I bought Leon Rosum's album of piping, never really. My father was a wood turner, and so there was a possibility that maybe we could have got together making pipes, but that never worked out really. What got me into fiddle making then was my brother Joe had a friend in Newry called Mick DeLargy, or Michael DeLargy, and Mick was a fiddle maker. My brother Joe actually would have probably been one of the people that influenced Mick in going that direction, but anyway, I would have been in Mick's workshop as a young lad, and so that inspired me towards fiddle making.
And on the topic, you're being put to the test now, Paul, not by me, but we have a question in from a listener, and the question is, how accurate are the labels on the inside of the violin? For example, and excuse my pronunciation here, if it says Antonius Hieronymus F.R. Amity, I'm probably making a very wrong pronunciation of that. The question is, could that be a copy, and how do you know how legitimate it is?
More than likely, you know, nearly always it is a German copy, and there are a Czechoslovakian copy, but usually German when you see that particular label. The Hieronymus Amati one. Yes. It is very highly unlikely that it's an original, because most of the Stradivari and Amati instruments are accounted for that are in existence.
Right.
But there may be yet one or two that'll turn up. You never know. But I would say, don't get your hopes high.
And just speaking of that, you know, saying most of them would be accounted for, would you be talking about like a handful of them, or would there be a couple of hundred of them in existence at this stage? Or do we have any idea?
I should know the answer to this, but I think that there are about 400.
Oh, right. OK, you're in the hundreds. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so just Paul, I just want to talk to you too, just about you're in the last year as well. I know it's been a strange time, and I was talking there about your influence from Tommy Peoples, because I saw a very, very interesting video of you taken very recently you were commissioned by, I think, Trad Connect, and you did a very informative... Trad Ireland. A very informative video on Tommy Peoples and his influence, and playing some music on that as well. Just from that point of view of the videoing and the change in scenery, and how you are, I suppose, teaching and doing masterclasses, to then going online and talking, we'll say, on video that you record yourself. How different is that for you?
I find teaching online is a very efficient way to teach. It obviously has some drawbacks, but what it does it's very economical with both of the teacher and the student's time, because there's no time for chatting. Generally, when you find, you know, both adults and children coming online, they're much better prepared. You know, for some reason, they seem to know what they're there to do, and there's no wasting time setting about doing it. And also the usual sort of nuances of etiquette and, you know, sociability are sort of put to the side largely. And say if someone is, you know, hammering away playing and they're doing okay, but maybe you sort of feel it's nearly time to call them in and say, well, let's talk about this. Yeah. You can do that more quickly and more efficiently online, I find, and no one takes offence. So that's one good thing I find. And also, like, I taught groups there during the Willie Clancy this year, or last year, online. So basically, when you're teaching, you've got to mute everybody. If it's a Zoom call, you've got to mute all the people. So, you know, obviously, with the delay online, people can't be playing together. So in a way, that makes it more efficient, because there's no people noodling or picking and plucking at strings, and there's none of that distraction, and everyone seems to understand and toe the line better. Whereas in the more social setting of a classroom, people are more inclined to have a chat, and, you know, energy gets lost, teaching energy gets lost in that, you know, although it's nice to have a chat. But you know, the online thing has many benefits in that sense, I find.
And the whole navigating the whole technology yourself as a new way, I suppose, of performing and teaching. How has that been?
I found making the video for Trad Ireland majorly challenging. More so than I expected, because I have, like, people, if you're on Facebook, you'd have seen my videos about my new fiddles and stuff, you know, and I sort of knocked those out quite easily, you know. But this wasn't so easy. It was probably because it was 20 minutes long, you know. And so therefore, like, I don't know anything about editing. I don't have an editing suite. I think the idea of it from their point of view was to have it as a sort of an amateur production anyway, like a telephone made on the phone. So what happened with me then was my phone ran out of storage, because I had made a few takes of this, and then I had nowhere to go. I didn't know how to solve that problem. And the delivery date was getting close, so it was getting a bit hard on the nerves, if you know what I mean.
I suppose. And it's something that I suppose is quite a challenge for lots of us. And even talking last week with Morella Murray, and they were talking of just doing a 1 hour recording for Cherish the Ladies, and it took 2 days, and that's with professional tech, you know, as well. And I suppose there's varying degrees of for artists. It's not just about being an artist anymore, but you have to, I suppose, develop all these new technical aids to help you along the way. And then as well as that, at home, I know you're a very, very busy family man, and there's music goes on every day in your house, I believe.
I suppose since lockdown started, I suppose with you know, the working life that we had been leading before and during the beginning of lockdown, we hadn't much time for music. I had a 2-weekly session here in Hollywood that I organized and invited people from various parts of the country to come to, you know. That was supported financially by the local pub here, Tutties, and that was, you know, it was great. But I used to find with the, you know, child minding and my own work here, and then my wife is a worker too, you know, it was just, I used to find it, oh God, I have to go out and play tonight, you know. And, you know, but then when I got out, I was, of course, you were glad to be out. It was energizing, you know. Whereas then when lockdown became more severe, then there was nothing at all, you know, and you were wishing you had your two weekly session to get out to, you know. We have decided recently that we'd stop anything we were doing and have 1 hour of music every day with our child there as well, you know, and get her to say maybe a wee poem or something, or join in singing a wee song, you know, and I'd play a few tunes and my wife would sing a few songs. My wife is a great singer, actually, Fitzgerald from Roscommon. But that's what we do every day now, you know, and it adds as part, I suppose, part of the survival of the situation we're in, you know.
Yeah, I mean, what a fantastic thing to do. And what, Rianach is your daughter, isn't that right?
That's right, Rianach,
what a fabulous experience for her. It's almost like going back in time, the way things used to be, I suppose, many, many years ago, sitting around in the evening and sharing a poem or a song or a tune as well, you know, within households.
Yeah, It brings us back. I suppose the lockdown will bring many people back to the basics and the bare necessities of life, and maybe that's one of the good sides of it.
Fantastic.
I suppose it sort of reminds me of a bit of traditional music during the Troubles in Belfast. You know, where, you know, people went out to play music. You know, you mightn't have felt so at ease going out at night in those days, you know, but it was the only thing that a lot, those who played traditional music, it was the only thing they really had, you know, left to them. And it intensified the experience and made it more meaningful as a community activity.
Well, on that note, I think, Paul, that can be said for the time people are going through at the moment. I know a lot of people are finding the resources and the generosity of musicians in sharing their music and song invaluable during these times. On that note, I'd like to just, can you just, for listeners to know, anybody that would like to get a bow rehaired or purchase any of your merchandise or inquire about classes or indeed to purchase one of your fiddles, where they can best do that?
I suppose at the moment my website is actually getting rebuilt, so it's not online functional at the moment, but Facebook, just my personal page, Paul Bradley. I also have a violin making page, Paul Bradley Violin Maker.
Perfect, and they can contact you through either of those sites on Facebook.
That's right.
Paul, we're just going to play another track as we say goodbye to you, and I'd like you to introduce it. I know we were talking during the week, and it's taken from your album Atlantic Roar, and you were telling me that your last track is probably one of your own favourites from the album. As I say goodbye to you, you might tell us about it and do an introduction.
Yeah, if you can remind me what the tunes are.
I can definitely remind you what the tunes are. There are Miss Crawford's Highland, The Green Fields of Tyrrell, The Nine Pint Coogie, and The Rat in the Tatch. A great combination of four tunes.
Yeah, so the first tune I heard both from Tommy Peoples and John Doherty's playing, that is Miss Crawford's Highland, and the first reel, the Green Fields of Tyrrell, from the playing of Tommy Peoples, he seems to have introduced that into the Irish repertory from the Scottish manuscript, I would say, and then the next tune
the
is
The Nine Pint Coogie.
The Nine Pint Coggy, or the Nine Pint Coggy, was a tune from John Doherty. I presume a coggy was probably some kind of tin, receptacle that John would have made, you know, maybe for, And then what was the last one then?
The Rat in the Tatch.
Oh, aye, The Rat in the Thatch. Now, I'm not sure if that is the correct title for that tune, but I got it from the playing of, it was from a mixture of Donegal players that somebody gave me, and I wasn't quite sure who it was playing, but I think it might have been from James Byrne and someone else playing together, you know. So they're all Donegal tunes.
Fantastic. Well, Paul Bradley, thanks a million for joining us today. And on that note, we will say goodbye and thank you for that introduction to the next track.
Thanks very much for having me, Cliona.
Take care. Bye for now. Bye.
Bye.